am a lawyer, but I am not necessarily your lawyer. The materials discussed in this podcast are for informational purposes only and should not be deemed legal advice. If you have a specific legal question according to your circumstances, then I encourage you to speak with an attorney licensed in your jurisdiction.
Welcome to the Ag Law Today podcast, where we educate you on all aspects of agriculture law, including business, farm estate planning, administration, regulatory, property, and family law that impact your life and business. Now, here's your host, Carrie Rinker with Rinker Law.
Welcome back to another edition of Ag Law Today. All the way from Montana, we've got Court Jensen in the house. Welcome to the podcast.
Glad to be here.
So, Court, why don't you start off by just introducing yourself to our listeners? Who are you? Where are you? And what do you do?
Sure. Obviously, as you said, I'm both born from and currently work for the state of Montana. I'm the chief attorney for the Montana Department of Agriculture. In Montana, we have a Department of Agriculture and a Department of Livestock, but I represent the agricultural side, but I handle issues involving both. I've always been in Montana, and I've always been, in my entire practice, a governmental attorney. I worked for the Attorney General before and for other government agencies, but for the last over a decade, I've been the Department of Agriculture's chief legal counsel. I've also taught ag law at the university here, and before going to the road of being a lawyer, my undergrad degree was in psychology, and I worked for Eastern Montana Mental Health as well. So. And given today's topic, I think that might be relevant.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Court, I don't know if you know this, but I actually lived in Montana very briefly. I lived in Bozeman. I was interning for the American Simmental Association there for a summer during my undergrad. And the skies really are bigger in Montana. Like, what is it about Montana and the skies are and the sunsets are just absolutely gorgeous?
You know, what it really makes it different, what tends to make it look bigger, because from a pure standpoint, you know, people in North Dakota would say, there's no way your skies can be any bigger. We have nothing to block our skies, and even less people. It really is that contrast between the mountains, the hills. It creates interesting temperature fronts, so you get the purple painted skies, and then you can get so far away from everybody and anything else that suddenly you can see not only the northern lights, but galaxies. It really does create those massive vistas of beauty.
Yeah, I visited some of my favorite ranches in the whole country out there in Montana. So since you were born and raised in Montana, where did you grow up exactly?
I grew up in Circle, Montana, which is, if you look at the map of Montana, there's a giant lake on the eastern side, which is often called the side. In Montana, they call it the flat side, but honestly, there's actually mountain ranges over there. They're just not as mountainous as the Rockies. But there's a big artificial lake with the biggest earthen dam in the world, Fort Peck Dam. Well, I guess it's the second biggest now. There's one in Africa bigger, but it's just a massive earthen structure that they built during the Great Depression. I lived right in that area. My dad was a sheriff. My mom was an art teacher, and they had both a farm and a ranch. And so I grew up from an agricultural background, but also with that more than one income background that's common of a lot of farmers.
So what attracted you to ag law? Like, what's sort of your path to want to become a lawyer, much less want to work with the agriculture industry?
Right out of law school, I actually was doing consumer protection and food, and I chased after used car dealers and con artists. But a lot of the cases I worked early on involved food law. And in the course of doing that as a baby attorney, I learned a lot about the ins and outs of how food regulation at the federal and state level worked. And when the opening came up about 10 years down my career path for Department of Agriculture, given my background as a kid and just what I knew about food, it was a good fit. And I planned to be here for 2 to 3 years, and now it's been a decade later, and I have no real plans to leave.
So it's interesting that you said that you've always been a government lawyer, you know, and I get a lot of pre-law students, maybe students in undergrad, or maybe even students who are in law school who want to become an ag lawyer. And what advice would you give to those people that want to perhaps be a government lawyer at the state or the federal level?
Here's when I taught law class, the first question I always would get asked is, hey, how do I get into being a state government attorney? And I said, the first thing, no matter what state you're in, federal, even the territories, ignore all the job requirements. Government positions have to post based on the ideal candidate. And so you'll see astronaut preferred, PhD. My first government job literally said, you need an LLM in consumer protection law. I walked in at the time and said, hey, I'm applying. And they're like, they go, do you have an LLM? And I'm like, nope. Heck, I don't even know if I passed the bar yet. And they're like, why on earth do you think you're qualified for this? Because I go, I'm like the person who wrote this description. There are no current LLM programs in consumer protection law. So your description is a dream. And that's the way it is for most positions. They list everything that the ideal candidate would take, but what they're paying is often right out of law school. And so I became the head of the consumer protection office as my first law. And that's because I ignored the requirements. And when you see it from prosecutors, from clerks, people basically talk themselves out of applying. And often early in a career, you'll make more as a government attorney than you will in private practice. And you can rack up experience, valuable contacts, public loan forgiveness. It's fantastic. And then there comes a point where the private sector does pay more, but a law job is very dependable. And it's easier to take time off and have quality of life as opposed to sure money.
Yeah, that's great advice, because I remember being straight out of law school and I never actually applied to be a government lawyer. I would look at jobs that were available with the USDA, but I never had the guts to apply because I did not feel like that I was qualified and the application just seemed laborious. It was like all this work for no reason. So I think that that is great advice for young people or newer attorneys who are interested in perhaps being a government attorney. So I'd like to talk about a question that comes across my desk a lot, more than what I wish that it did, was dealing with problematic neighbors. So, Court, from your perspective, why is this an agricultural issue?
Because everybody has bad neighbors. But most people's bad neighbors affect their private life, not their actual job. Like having a bad neighbor, if you live in the city, yeah, it's annoying. Yes, it can make your life less enjoyable, but it probably doesn't affect your actual job. It doesn't affect your livelihood. Whereas bad agricultural neighbors absolutely affect everything you do, not only the safety of your property, but whether or not you can even make a functioning crop, and can often limit what you plan to do with your own land. And so it tends to take all of the stress, all of the pain and anguish that people see in any situation with bad neighbors and put a real dollar value cost to it, which tends to unfortunately accelerate bad behavior on both sides of the situation.
Can you give me some examples of things that you have seen, you know, personally?
Oh, absolutely. We get a lot of calls. We run a mediation service in the Department of Agriculture here in Montana. So it makes it a little different, but just in general, as chief legal counsel, people often call, get bounced up here. And so we hear a lot about it when things are going wrong and people are at least trying to fix it. And there's some common ones, but ones involving easements, basically, especially if someone has to cross your property, and that involves everything from open gates to broken pivots as people go through, cattle ending up on the road, driving too fast. People who basically say they wanted to change the nature of their farm. They wanted to go from, say, a field crop to a pig barn. And nothing will make you get to know your neighbors quicker than putting a pig barn on a property line. Surprisingly enough, on all sides, people's inability to control a canine, if it's going to attack neighbors' cattle, harass neighbors' horses, or even their kids. And counterwise, there's always the dog got loose and there's a new neighbor. And when the new neighbor saw the dog, they just shot it. That will really sour a relationship from the get-go.
Yeah, Court, I have seen all of those issues and probably just in the last few months. And I'd like to also add some property line disputes might pop up with neighbors. Those kind of, they've come across my desk too. So when you're talking about neighbors that are disputing perhaps about a potential nuisance, maybe the neighbor thinks that there's a nuisance, there's something called the right to farm. So is that come into play in those kinds of disputes?
Yes, and it really varies from state to state, because while every state has some language of right to farm, Montana does double duty. We have two different laws that are called right to farm that have nothing to do with each other. You have to really look to see what your right to farm is. In its most basic sense, most right to farm laws exempt you from either local regulation or they exempt you from nuisancing, being private or public. A private nuisance is a nuisance that bothers the individual, but not everybody. The public nuisance would be one that would bother any and all neighbors in a nearby radius. Mm-hmm. It's the difference between poking somebody in particular and being pig pen on the old Charlie Brown thing, where it just kind of radiates nuisance. But right to farm often will exempt it if the farm was in operation usually longer than whatever it's annoying. And that's like very vague because each one is a little different. Sometimes you have to be have been in operation for a long period of time. Sometimes you have to be outside of city limits. Sometimes it allows city limits to grow around you and you still have all the advantages of being outside city limits. And obviously in states like Montana right now with COVID, we're seeing this massive influx of people, we'll call them from the coasts, that the being locked up in a big urban area seemed painful. So they went and bought a vacation home or a dream home in rural Montana, sight unseen. They show up and are vastly surprised by what all goes on in an agricultural operation on all sides of them.
Yeah. That does not surprise me, Court. As you said, the right to farm law is highly state specific. You know, I can tell you because I spent, you know, a decade of my life practicing law in New York, and I still do some, even though I don't reside there full time, that farmers had to be using good farming practices in an agricultural district, which was is a different district than what is a zoning district. So every law, you know, every state has their own little nuances here with the right to farm. And so farmers listening to this should absolutely consult with an attorney licensed in your jurisdiction. And Court, I'm so glad that you mentioned the agriculture mediation program because I'm on the agriculture mediation roster for New York, New Jersey, and I'm almost on the roster here in Illinois as well. And so I'm so glad to hear that Montana has a similar program. And I feel like, from my perspective, I feel like they are, it's really underutilized. I know that the program is limited in its funding to right to farm disputes and federal farm program disputes. But what would be your suggestions to farmers who are wanting to participate in a program like that?
One, reach out, usually either the state bar or even the USDA office from Farm Services will have a list of who the official farm mediators are and what sort of disputes are covered there. Some of the discretion in the last farm bill gave a little more, that they can go broader.
That's good.
And realistically, like with us, like we're the official one for USDA to farmer disputes, but to maintain our training and to get enough dispute cases, because we got a relatively rural case, we offer that service basically at no cost to anything with a primarily agricultural core to it, from wills and estates, but a lot of it's neighbor disputes. And what makes mediation different than litigation? Litigation is where you go to fight to the death in a lot of cases if you're not careful. But if you know you're not, like you and the neighbor are going to have to get along, you and your grain elevator are going to have to at some point reach an understanding. Mediation tries to save both the relationship and deal with the problem. And so in these type of disputes, it gives you potentially a way to de-escalate as opposed to increase the tension with the neighbor.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do litigation and I can tell you that it gets really expensive. And I'm so thankful that there are mediation programs that are available at, you know, that are free to those in the agriculture industry. That's fantastic. So what are some quirks in various state laws that you've seen that cause these agricultural headaches when dealing with neighbors?
The ones, and years ago, like when I first started, everybody would always say it's got to be pesticide. I haven't seen a pesticide dispute between farming neighbors in a long time. It just has not happened. Like the old classic case of I think they're spraying and it's drifting on my property. There was a little bit of that every once in a while. When I first started, that has kind of faded. The ones that get people are, there's been some laws that basically expanded that right to farm in many states to include changing in farm operations. And so where before your neighbor was lovely and had these beautiful fields of lavender or, you know, flax turning blue, and it was always such a lovely, pretty neighbor to have. And now it's sold out and instead a more industrialized farm or a colony has put in a giant pig or chicken barn. And they decided to place it as far away from their house as possible, but that ends it right at the property line, which put it in your backyard. And now they're saying you can't do anything because it's a right to farm. And you may be a farmer yourself, but you're like, well, you could have located the pig barn somewhere other than my backyard. So that we've seen a lot of that tension or that change in farm operations. Occasionally, when you get a neighbor, one neighbor switches to organic farming. At the same time, another neighbor decides that GMO alfalfa is what their dream is. And suddenly one or the other has to move if they can't really get some good farm practices between the two to figure out how that's going to work. And when the other one that tends to sneak up and surprise people is junk vehicles and junk vehicle laws. Most states have special rules when it, you know, both for salvage yards, which people were expecting, but farmers often have, like in Montana, for example, the right to have inoperable vehicles anywhere and everywhere on their property for as long as they want for spare parts. And there really is no intel or less. And so somebody's like, my neighbor effectively has a salvage yard of old tractors and pickup trucks in between my view of the mountains that I paid millions of dollars. And instead of having a view of the mountains, I have a view of really old international harvesters, which some people would pay money for. But those junk vehicle laws get to it. The right to have a working, most barking ordinances don't apply to farm animals in like states like Montana. And so the county ordinance against barking dogs is great, but there's often a little catch in there in the county ordinance that says, unless it's working sheep, in which case it can bark all it wants to keep the wolves away. Well, that's great for the guy with the sheep, but if you don't have any sheep, you have corn, that gets really annoying fairly quickly.
So, Court, I always feel that before clients come to me with a dispute with a neighbor, that there were things that they could have done differently to prevent the problem from happening, right, in the first place. Yeah. So what would be your biggest pieces of advice for landowners who maybe don't have a problem now, or maybe they are starting to have a little bit of a problem with a neighbor? What can they do from the very onset of that dispute?
Well, the first one that I always would wish I could tell people, like with the back, as a lawyer, you always wish you had that time machine to go back to tell them how this could have been prevented, is when you create your own neighbors, when you subdivided your own property and did so with vague notions of easements, road maintenance contracts, if you're going to sell part of your own land to somebody, even if they're currently a blood relative or a child, that could go to somewhere else at some point later. Don't leave that for someone else. Get those easements firmed up, get them clarified. Likewise, you know, getting to know your neighbor so that the first interaction isn't a negative one is always good advice. You know, it's easier to talk through something. If the barking dog or the broken pivot is the first time you have that conversation with the new neighbor, it rarely goes well and it tends to sour all future conversations. And then my last one that, and I'll just leave it to three, figure out what the, you know, when it has gone bad, how much would you pay a lawyer to make it go away? And if you're not willing to just offer that to the neighbor to make it stop, you may be wasting your money. Because oftentimes you end up with a sense of lawyers are incredibly expensive tools of vengeance. And you could have solved the problem.
I hate it, Court, when people come to me because I'm very pragmatic. I think very much with a business head. I encourage my clients to think with a business head. And the worst thing that I hear sometimes, well, Carrie, it's about the principle of the thing. No, this is your livelihood, right? You need to think with a business cap. So, Court, any other last closing thoughts on this issue?
The other one is, if you can remain calm and clarify and document how the dispute escalates, if it involves law enforcement, a lawyer, or mediation later, it can seem petty and pedantic to sit there and on this date, this happened, this is what I did, this is how I tried to prevent it, how to mitigate the harm. But if you ever want like a sheriff's deputy to actually do a trespass case, or you want a lawyer to actually try to quiet an easement dispute, you're going to really have that documentation done. And you're going to have your paperwork with you. And sometimes that can really help clarify. I know when I talk to the Sheriff's Officers Association, they always say, when the neighbor dispute's gotten so bad, you start blaming each other for things that the other party couldn't possibly have done. And the classic example is we saw one where people were just about to the point of violence, and it involved, because teenagers were driving on this easement and making out. And we had both people in the room, and we said, like, either one of you wants teenagers driving on that road to make out? It's not either one of your kids. So stop blaming each other about these teenagers. That's a whole different problem than the dispute you guys are having about how many vehicles the both of you and what type of vehicles and what size of tire. Don't bring the teenagers up. Don't bring them to the sheriff. Don't try to bring it in this case. But everything tends to escalate if you let it. And so document it and try to stay calm.
And I think that's great advice. In fact, one of the things that I give to my clients sometimes is an actual journal, because those handwritten notes can be really helpful. And then if things ensue to litigation and I have to then put somebody up on the stand and they forget about what happened on such and such a date, I could literally hand them that same journal or their notes or whatever, you know, their notes on their phone, whatever they use. To refresh their recollection. So, Court, in closing, if listeners are having a dispute with a neighbor and they want to know where they can find an ag lawyer that really understands this problem in their either their community or in their jurisdiction. What advice would you give to people on how to find the right person?
Don't take the guy with the flashy ads that talks about justice. This is a very different type of litigation practice and policy. So you're going to want to ask for someone who has an ag law background, and ideally somebody who has a real, since most of these involve property law, an understanding of property law. So when you see someone who says, hey, their specialty is agriculture and property law, that's what you, honestly, a good source, in addition to like this classic state bar, talk to your banker. Bankers often have a good line on who doesn't cause problems and can get easements settled in a manner that will make bankers happy. And if bankers are happy, that usually means you've resolved the issue.
That's good advice. All right, Court. So do you have any contact information? Where can folks find you online?
I'm a lawyer named Court, C-O-R-T Jensen. I don't do private practice, but usually, obviously, people just, my number is available at the Department of Ag. So I would highly recommend. The other one is, I have this lovely mug here from the ALA, American Agricultural Law Association. That's a good place to look and look at their membership. That's a good sign that the person in question is practicing agricultural law and at least has thought through the basics of how this should be handled.
All great advice. My memory serves me correctly, that's where we originally met, was at AALA. I don't even know how many years ago at this point. So time flies when you're having fun.
I think it might have been all the way back in Wilmington.
But. Yeah, wow. I had just graduated from law school around those days. So I think that was like my first AALA conference, which stands for the American Agriculture Law Association, which has a great Rolodex of very talented ag lawyers from coast to coast. Well, thanks for coming to the podcast, Court. I appreciate the conversation.
Thank you for listening to the Ag Law Today podcast. If you found this episode valuable, please subscribe to the show so you never miss out on new episodes. Share it with your friends and leave a review. We would be so grateful. Check out all the latest episodes on our website at www.aglawtodaypodcast.com. Connect with Carrie on Twitter and LinkedIn with the handles Carrie Rinker and Rinker Law. Follow Ag Law Today on Facebook and on Instagram. A special shout out to the Purdue University Extension Education Department for their support and collaboration on this podcast. See you next time.